Today on Between the Lines, a side never before seen about the larger-than-life author Hunter S. Thompson, with my guest and Hunter's son, Juan Thompson. Welcome, I'm Barry Kibrick. The term gonzo journalism was coined after the exploits and writings of Hunter S. Thompson. His fierce prose was often overshadowed by his one-of-a-kind lifestyle. Portrayed in film by Johnny Depp in Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, his real life was even larger than the big screen could hold. But there is another side to Hunter, and with his book, Stories I Tell Myself, his son Juan Thompson gives us an intimate portrayal of what it was like growing up with an iconic legend.
I'm a writer today because I was a reader when I was 11 years old, and it was...
You do not need to prove your state of happiness to anybody.
Most of these speeches were as much as a month in preparation.
The characters, the heroes in this book are seekers of truth in a story that involves a lot of corruption.
I don't get a chance to really talk about what's real. And it's the first thing to do.
Juan, it is a wonderful privilege to have you on. Obviously, we're all fans of your dad's work, but your work here, as I talked to you a little bit earlier, is so beautiful itself. Thank you, Juan.
Well, thank you very much for having me. Thank you.
It is my pleasure. You know, this is a story of growing up with an iconic legend, as your dad was. And you're very open about how tough it was for you at a certain age in particular that you had to deal with this. And yet there is a reconciliation that you really even begin to realize when you become a dad yourself and you realize the love that may not have appeared to have been there. Yeah. I found that to be something that moved me personally when a man realizes the love was there.
Yeah, and that took a long time for me to fully realize. I think I write in the book how when I was in my early 20s, I had an epiphany where I realized that my dad was not going to change. That was never going to happen. And if I was going to have a relationship with him, I needed to start with accepting that he's not going to change. But having that realization and then progressing to really accepting him, and then, as you say, to starting to understand how that he really did love me, but that he just didn't show it in the way that I, you know, expected to see it. I mean, that took a long time. It took, you know, gosh, 10, 15 years, and probably even into writing the book as it sort of sank in more.
Yeah, in fact, it's interesting because you make the realization in time enough to really heal with your dad, which I know must have really lightened that load for you.
Oh, yes.
And yet, though even, as you said, even afterwards, years after his death, it even becomes deeper and deeper entrenched. So there's a beauty about it on so many levels like that, because, gosh, what guilt could you have felt if you didn't know? Because later on you learn stuff, and we'll get into it, from others even, how much he loved you and cared for you.
Yes, I think about that often. I feel so grateful that, first of all, that my dad was willing to... that I didn't give up and that he didn't give up, that we both kept trying to connect, even though, you know, we didn't really understand each other or we didn't understand how to communicate, but that we didn't give up and that we got to the point so that, you know, when he died, I could say, you know, we were in a good place. We were in a good place. And I'm just so grateful for that. It would have been so, so much harder to be trying to work that out without him.
Well, you know, the question that you say in the book is that everyone always asks you, what's it like growing up with this? He was known, he didn't create the term. The term was created for him as Gonzo journalist. Mm-hmm. And he lived a life even more Gonzo than the journalism that he wrote about. So his life was even wilder than the exploits are. So Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas is nothing compared to the real actions that were taken. And yet, at the same time, even though that question is asked, you realize that it was his destiny to make us all wake up. That's, I'll use your words. He makes us wake up and take notice. He's the truth teller, the shaman, the witch doctor, and the intermediary between our world and the realm of the gods. Now, that is a beautifully written sentence by you, yet that has to be a tough thing to live with when you're just a young boy and there is this iconic legend and you're not aware of all of this.
And he was such a, just such a powerful presence, you know, physically. I mean, he was a big man. He was, you know, deep voice, loud, and just, you know, a dominating presence. And as a kid, it was, I mean, he was intimidating. At best, it was intimidating. At worst, it was, you know, terrifying.
But, you know, intimidating when, at first, as I was reading it, I even was thinking more horribly, and this is in the, it's funny too, because as you say, people always think even more horribly than the reality is. That's why I'm so glad we're here, because I was even thinking it was wilder than it could be wild. And yet, as you say, he, you know, there's also a part of him that when you realize the love he had for you, it even surprises the reader. I know that sounds funny because you don't think he's capable of it, really, even as you're reading it. And then when you see it, you go, wow, it makes him more special in a certain way.
I mean, it was, I'd say, a gift when I began to realize, and, you know, with the help of my wife and his, you know, and his assistant, Deb Fuller, they gave me some sort of hints, you know, as to how to interpret it. And it was such a gift to realize, my God, you know, he really does. Or at first it was like, maybe he does love me, you know? And then as I considered that possibility and was open to it, you know, I was able to see it more clearly. And someone asked a question recently about why do I think my dad chose to kill himself when I was in the house? And this may seem like a strange thing to say, but I think he wanted me there. And it was a odd form of respect. And just saying that, it sounds strange.
Join us each week on the Well Beyond Medicine podcast as we explore the 80% of child health impacts that occur outside the doctor's office. Listen and subscribe at nemourswellbeyond.org, where you'll hear pediatric experts, researchers, and policymakers from around the world discussing ways they are revolutionizing children's health. I'm your host, Carol Vassar. Let's go.
You know, it sounds more strange when you're saying it, but when you write it, the beauty of your writing, it felt so, I'm going to try to grasp for a word, it felt so endemic to the situation because, as you said, one of the bonding rituals you had was the cleaning of the guns.
Yeah.
And he was very into all forms of weaponry and bombs and everything yeah. like that. And the cleaning of the guns, and by the way, and you mentioned this in the book, the rumor is always that this was a Hemingway-esque kind of killing, as you, yes. you know, where he blew his head off with a shotgun and yeah. the family just, and it's nothing like that. There is a, almost such a beautiful peace and ritual. You used even the term ritual to his death, where you clean the gun. You have no idea Thank what's God. Going on, yeah. you know. Yeah. You clean the gun, and he does it with such precision. So that, and he wants you there also, according to what you even learn later, was he didn't want someone to tell you and then to discover his body and whatever. He did it in such a way that when you actually, you thought a book dropped off the floor, and when yeah. you walked up to his room, you thought he was sleeping.
Yeah.
And that's very unusual when a man uses a gun to kill himself, but he prepared it in such a way. And that's why I do think yeah. it, and your son was there too, who he bonded with, and your wife, yeah. And like you said, when you read this, it not only doesn't sound strange, it sounds beautiful.
If I could change one thing, it would be, I wish my son hadn't been there. Now, he never actually saw Hunter's body, but I wish he hadn't been there, because it was really tough on him. Because he didn't know what was happening. He just knew that something terrible had happened.
You mentioned about sparing of your own son, Will. And I thought that over a lot when I was reading this. And I said, and again, I'm only going by what you wrote, so I can't know this for a fact, but it almost seems that Hunter wasn't the type of man to not want his grandson there either. And it seemed like I know this sounds, well, no, you're agreeing with me. I can see by the way you're nodding, because he, no matter what, still was more concerned about himself. He was a self-centered man. There was no doubt about it. But I don't think that was even the reason. I think it was, again, a full circle of life. And just as he didn't spare you necessarily, he wasn't going to spare his grandchild. And I think, if anything, as you come to the reconciliation with all of it in your life, I firmly believe the way you write this story that Will, your son, will come to that same recollection and that same relief almost.
I'd never really thought of it that way, but that seems very consistent with his with Hunter's way of living, that he would not have, he was not one to, hold back on what he considered important truths.
That's the first, because when you wrote about that, that was the first thing that, came into my mind, was the important truths. That, and I thought, I'm so glad you said that, because that was the key that made me turn around and see it the other way.
And I hope you're right. I hope that he does come to that point where, in time he sees, well, I'm glad I was there, in a way.
Yeah, I'm telling you, let him read the book a few more times and he will become that way. One of the things that, and again, I think this occurs now, this occurs when Dad's alive, but I believe the recollection occurs after his passing, is Dad knew full well that he was not really a good father. By that I mean not appropriate yeah. for you. Yeah. He knew that his actions, his wild man, like you said, to him, cocaine, alcohol, and LSD were to everyone else like vitamins and orange juice, okay? And that's just the way it was. Yeah. When he was, in fact, in pain, the reason why he kills himself is he's, so everyone knows, he was in real physical pain at that time and couldn't live the life he wanted to live. He was going through such alcohol withdrawals that the doctors couldn't even give him enough through the IV. So that's how, but he wasn't in a weird way an alcoholic. I know that sounds crazy, because he wasn't affected negatively by it. He was just the way he was, but he was aware of it. And you find this out
And of course, it's kind of funny now when you think of who Jimmy Buffett is, as if you're going to a less of a. That's the story. He sends you to Jimmy Buffett because that's how wild and crazy Hunter is. Jimmy Buffett's going to be a stabilizing effect on you. And he literally sends you off to be Jimmy Buffett's cabin boy before Jimmy Buffett is even famous. But he still is himself a very wild man. And yet Jimmy is aware, and he says to you, and you sense this surrogate father, he said, Hunter was very concerned about the effects that his lifestyle would have on you.
As you say, I mean, being a father was first of all, it wasn't his top priority, you know, being a writer was. And he and I were so different. I don't think he really knew how to be a father to me, even if that had been a focus for him. And the other thing was when I was able to, you know, accept him and forgive him, and for him, you know, for me to know that he did love me, and for him to know that I had forgiven him, I mean, those were I can't even think of the word. They were so important. I mean, it was those two things that made it possible for us to, you know, be in a good place.
You know, it's funny, and I guess you can't help it because I'm with his son, so we're talking in somewhat somber tones, but yet you can't really do that all day long with Hunter S. Thompson because he is a wild man. So I want to get into some of the wild stuff because it really is, on one level, not necessarily for a son to appreciate, but for everyone else, it's crazy. And one of the things just in itself might, we'll get to the funeral, I hope we'll have time, but Hunter and Money, and you bring that up. And as you say, I'm going to just read it. When he had it, he squandered it with such abandonment, it was unbelievable. And then when he needed to cobble it back together, he'd have to write something, do something, but he always managed to finagle it just enough to get by. But, you know, even at his death, Johnny Depp has to, not chip in so much because the family couldn't afford the funeral, but because Hunter's demands for the funeral were so humongous, Johnny Depp builds a cannon because Hunter decides he wants his ashes flung over the family home of the Owl Farm, which we'll talk about, and he builds a cannon larger than the Statue of Liberty. By the way, it tells you how much people loved your dad. Johnny Depp, a classic example, who loved your dad with such passion, he went all out.
Yes, he did, and that's a really good point. It's, I mean, his demands were it was outrageous, you know, and not just shoot the ashes over the house. It was, shoot them out of a cannon, on the bluff, overlooking the house, and by cannon he didn't mean like a little cannon. He meant a big cannon. You know, and but you're absolutely right. It was Johnny spent months with Hunter learning everything. You know, all of his movements and voice and everything as part preparing for the movie, and they really became quite close. And I think you're absolutely right. It's Johnny didn't do it for the publicity. You know, it was not even mentioned. He did it because. Because he loved and admired him, and he was able to, and so he did it.
That's what you get a sense. As crazy, and I can say that to his son, as crazy as dad was, and by the way, as crazy as he wasn't. That's the kind of interesting dichotomy. Yeah. Like you said, he has the complexities and contradictions of any 10 men combined, so there's no doubt about it. But there's something here that you talk about, and it was comfort in ritual. I personally also find a lot of comfort in ritual. For your dad and you, it was cleaning of the guns. It was swimming. a little bit together as well. And you say these words, he wasn't religious in a conventional sense. My God, how could he be? He's Hunter S. Thompson. But he believed very strongly in an inherent moral order and in the concept of righteousness. And he believed in unseen forces that enforced that order. And when I was reading it, you talk about one of those unseen forces in here that was so precious to him, and it was a medallion that he wore. And I was afraid to ask you to bring it, but if you don't mind, you did bring it, and I want to show people it, because it's just, you know, it as you said, when you wear it, you get a sense to feel his presence when it's there. And he believed in those things. He believed in a sort of shamanistic kind of ritual. He believed in that, even I think, again, when it comes to the cleaning of the gun. I know that sounds horrible, but I know that he wanted it because he knew that you would do it so perfectly and so precise. It was a loving act. And then leaving you with the medallion was, I had to ask if you could bring it.
Yeah. This was, there's, Hunter was a pack rat, and there was, his archive came to like 800 boxes of stuff, and that's just the archive. Then there's, his hell farm, his house. But I've over the years, I've thought, if there's only one thing that I could keep of my dad's, it would be this. And so I wear it as a, like, when I want to invoke his presence,
I have a thing now myself that I get into, and it's very funny. You know, when a person passes, the thing they always like to say is rest in peace. And you know, and I know that Hunter is not resting in peace. And I believe almost that's the wrong thing to say anyway to anyone, because you're not resting in peace. If you believe like Hunter believes, like I believe, and like many people believe on their own, for everyone has their own way of believing it, but there is an everlasting form of life and consciousness. And therefore, that consciousness is going somewhere when that body may not be. And I think if anyone had that power, it would have to be someone like your dad.
I am not a religious person, and I can't make any good argument for why I think my dad's spirit is out there somewhere, but I just can't imagine that all of that energy and intensity and passion is just gone. I just have to believe that there's, that it's out there somewhere. And I think you're right. I think I don't think he'd be interested in a permanent vacation, I think he'd want to be, all right, there's, there's wrongs to be righted here,
There is. There's work still to be done. Am I right? I love when we're in sync like this, because as I'm reading it, you're going, and this is the other thing is, there are biographies, there's all sorts of things about Hunter that don't show him from the point of view of the son. And you again, when your own son is born, you begin to really realize that a father's love and is there at a depth that exists no matter what. Yeah. And that's when you really begin to, and by the way, Hunter himself begins to unpeel and unfold. And he does it, it's very funny how a writer of this phenomena is such a man of little words.
Yes.
I can't believe it. You would say something so heavy, and he would say, good, makes sense. I know, am I right? I mean, it's something just like that. Yeah. And you'd think, I was waiting for him to come out with some sort of revelation, but no, only with the pen maybe.
Yes, exactly. And that was one of the most difficult things to realize about Hunter is that he was not speak from his heart to me, and that we were not going to have these conversations where, we would speak of meaningful things late into the night, that just wasn't the nature of our relationship, but that's what I wanted for so long. And then I finally realized, all right, that's not where the relationship is. It's not in those conversations. It's in spending time together. And you know, sharing in something like, you know, a good movie or the swimming. But it was a difficult thing for me to understand, is that, all right, this is not going to happen through talking, is it? You know, maybe for some people or some fathers and sons, that's how it works. But I'm starting to think that for a lot of fathers and sons, it doesn't necessarily, they don't have those meaningful conversations, and that's okay.
You know, and that's what you realize, and I'm going to end with these words, that I emerged from the maelstrom of his own life, appearing relatively normal, filled him with wonder and pride. And we also thank you, Juan, for emerging from that maelstrom and sharing the great Hunter S. Thompson's life with us. Thank you, sir, so much.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
It's my pleasure. And thank you all for joining us. Now, before Juan leaves, I'd like to leave you with these few more words from Stories I Tell Myself. At the end, I am left with gratitude. Gratitude for the combination of luck, perseverance, blessings of the gods, the flashes of insight, willingness, and mutual need that made it possible for my father and me to heal the damage from those early years before it was too late. For this, I am deeply thankful. I'm Barry Kibrick. Heal the damages between all those you love, and you too will be deeply thankful. Thank you, dear Juan. Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast and want to hear more, please subscribe or become a patron of the show at BarryKibrick.com to keep it going every week. Thank you.